I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with Adam Begley, biographer of our late great man of letters, John Updike, literally a book a year man for more than 50 years, novelist, story writer, poet, reviewer, essayist, among other things. John Updike may be most widely remembered for putting Sex in the Suburbs onto the high shelf of literature, also for recounting the slugger Ted Williams' last at-bat. But Adam Begley has discovered much more about the life of the man and the amazingly swift process of his creation. We're going to sample our own radio files, too, of John Updike reading, inspiring callers, testifying to his own stubborn attachment to religious faith. And the writer Nicholson Baker is going to testify how the most ardent Updikeans miss their man. But first to Adam Begley and his biography. We recorded this conversation in the Boston Athenaeum, looking out at the old granary burying ground where Mother Goose is buried. It's a spot where we interviewed John Updike back in the day. I told Begley, for starters, that the range of his story and of Updike's imagination reminded me how often I used to say to our producer, Mary McGrath, "What's John Updike thinking about the expanding universe, or Barack Obama on the rise, or the Red Sox in a pennant race?" He also reminds you how fine were the Updike short stories.
He could turn anything into fiction. The late Justin Kaplan used to say that if you saw someone at his house with a bare feet and a hangnail, you could bet that in next week's New Yorker there would be a character in the story with a hangnail. He picked up on little details, and if they could be worked on, and if they could be shaded and arranged in a way that would make art, he would do it. It was a trick of the trade.
And let's give him credit for adding incredible grace notes to the hangnail. I'm thinking the story you reference called Incest. It's not exactly about incest, but it's about a young man himself and his young wife and their baby in a New York apartment, and it streaks through his mind as the baby is calling and crabbing how much he'd rather be listening to the Red Sox game. And he says, like many Americans, Lee in this story had a spiritual dependency on Ted Williams. And I thought, wow.
Updike himself had something of a spiritual dependency on Ted Williams.
So do I.
He went to see him play when he was still living in Shillington, Pennsylvania. And Williams hit a couple of home runs and Updike was hooked. He used to joke that he moved to Ipswich, Massachusetts in 1957 to be closer to his hero.
And it wasn't Hawthorne or Emerson, it was Williams.
It was Ted Williams. And then, of course, Ted Williams features in one of the great turning points of Updike's life, which is when he went to see Williams's last at-bat, which, of course, famously hit a home run. The afternoon was significant for several reasons. One is that out of it came probably the best piece of sports writing in American literature, Hub fans bid Kid adieu. And the other reason it's significant is because the whole reason he was at the game was that he'd gone to Boston to meet a woman who was not his wife for an assignation, or at least so he tells us. And the woman wasn't home, and so instead he went to the ball game.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. The local hero in your story of John Updike really is that woman who wasn't home that day when he stopped by for some sort of matinee tryst. She wasn't there, so he, not a man to waste an afternoon, went and wrote the best sports piece that we'll ever remember from the 20th century.
That's right. And then 15 years later, when he was about to get married to his second wife, he wrote a little introduction to that piece of sports writing.
Well, that would explain it all.
Well, he wrote a little introduction in which he said that this was possibly his first assignation that didn't happen. But really, he was saying goodbye to those assignations because he was about to marry his second wife and putting behind him a period of his life of absolutely turbulent extramarital sexual activity.
It's a perfect example of his process, turning something around. Ted Williams' last home run becomes an analogy of John Updike's last strikeout, so to speak.
Yeah, there were a lot of moments in that marvelous piece when it seems clear to me that Updike is talking not only about baseball, but about writing.
Absolutely.
Williams' dedication to his craft, his honing every single motion of a swing, his willingness to show up every day and play his best, whether it's a big game or not a big game.
Yep.
This is like Updike sitting down every day and writing for his 3 hours and churning out his requisite number of pages. Updike conceived of the business of writing as a craft and a kind of an office job. I mean, he brought to it passion, of course, but he was a consummate professional.
Here's the actor Jack Davidson at New York City's Symphony Space reading the end of that New Yorker piece, Hub Fans Bid Kid Adieu, about Ted Williams' last swing in Fenway Park, September 1960. John Updike was 28 years old.
Williams swung again, and there it was. The ball climbed on a diagonal line into the vast volume of air over center field. From my angle behind third base, the ball seemed less an object in flight than the tip of a towering, motionless construct, like the Eiffel Tower or the Tappan Zee Bridge. It was in the books while it was in the sky. Brandt ran back to the deepest corner of the outfield grass. The ball descended beyond his reach and struck in the crotch where the bullpen met the wall, bounced chunkily, and vanished. Like a feather caught in the vortex, Williams ran around a square of bases at the center of our beseeching screaming. He ran as he always ran out home runs, hurriedly, unsmiling, head down, as if our praise were a storm of rain to get out of. He didn't tip his cap. Though we thumped, wept, chanted, "We want Ted!" For minutes after he hid in the dugout, he did not come back. Our noise for some seconds passed beyond excitement into some kind of immense open anguish, a wailing, a cry to be saved. But immortality is non-transferable. The paper said that the other players and even the umpires on the field begged him to come out and acknowledge us in some way, but he refused. Gods do not answer letters.
To me, the news of your wonderful book, Adam Begley, is this way he worked and the way he turned things around. You have that wonderful saga of a journalist who went to his hometown at his mother's invitation for a tour. Updike was annoyed that his mother had sort of preempted him. And before the journalist could get his thing into print, Updike had a story about an aging actor going back to his hometown with a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was fodder, his children, his wives, his girlfriends. Who is this guy?
Well, he was a man who had tremendous confidence in his art. And he felt that his art sanctioned him to use the people around him, that he was going to take from them their hoard of experience and use it in his art and make something that was more precious, believe it or not, than their lives. There's an ethical question mark over that.
Let's talk about it. Who got hurt?
Starting
with his mother's feelings when he described a woman in a story about Pennsylvania as kind of doughy and unexciting and unbeautiful. And it burned her, at least for a week, until she decided, well, that's a pretty fair description.
Yes. Well, she was, as Updike said, a fan of the horrible, jubilant truth. And Updike was a truth teller. And if you were near him and couldn't accept the idea of finding yourself in his fiction, that would be hard. But I think everybody around him had to come to the decision that this was right, that this was okay. I know his wives did eventually. I think it was hard for both of them at times. His children, it was difficult for. One of the most heartbreaking television interviews I've ever seen was with John's oldest son, David, who told a documentary interviewer that his father had decided to put his writing ahead of his personal relations. And when he says it, his voice sounds like he's on the verge of tears. And you understand that this was painful for a child to know that his father really thought that his writing was more important than being a parent. The fact is, though, that I'm glad Updike used the people around him the way he did. Some of his most powerful stories are about intimate family things. I'm sure that his family regretted at times that he published the story called Separating, about the way he and his first wife decided to announce the breakup of their marriage to the assembled children. But that story is tremendous, grabs at the heart and wrings it. And you know what? The momentary embarrassment or discomfort of his children is, I think, a fair price to pay. I'm prepared to have them tell me I'm wrong, but I'm a great believer in literature. I think that, you know, a great poem, as someone famously once said, is worth any number of grandmothers.
This is John Updike reading from that story called Separating. The characters called Richard and Joan Maple are enacting their last family dinner. They're about to tell their four children over champagne and lobster that the marriage is over.
The tears would not stop leaking through. They came not through a hole that could be plugged, but through a permeable spot in a membrane, steadily, purely, endlessly, fruitfully. They became his tears, a shield for himself against these others, their faces, the fact of their assembly, a last time as innocents, at a table where he sat the last time as hid. Tears dropped from his nose as he broke the lobster's back. Salt flavored his champagne as he sipped it. The raw clench at the back of his throat was delicious. He could not help himself. His children tried to ignore his tears. Judith, on his right, lit a cigarette, gazed upward in the direction of her too energetic, too sophisticated exhalation. On her other side, John earnestly bent his face to the extraction of the last morsels, legs, tail segments, from the scarlet corpse. Between them, Margaret, no longer called Bean, 13 and large for her age, gazed from the other side of his pane of tears as if into a shop window at something she coveted. Her father, a crystalline heap of splinters and memories.
I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source, summoning the late literary marvel John Updike in our guest Adam Begley's biography and in our radio archives. Here we were just before Christmas in the year 2000. Updike had just published the fifth in his Rabbit series, each entry distilling an American decade. The last was a novella called Rabbit Remembered, set between Rabbit Angstrom's death in 1990 and the end of the millennium. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. John Updike's Rabbit Saga is now a quintet of novels and decades, from the 1950s to the millennial moment at the end of 1999. Since Rabbit himself went to his rest 10 years ago in 1989, you could think of the fifth Rabbit book as his ghost's story. It's also a sort of soap opera of the circle that Rabbit left behind in Brewer, Pennsylvania. It's also, like the earlier Rabbit books, John Updike's notebook on America, and nobody notices it all better. Windows 98, The New Las Vegas, the wimpy image of Andrew Jackson, the old Indian killer on the new $20 bill, email humor, Hillary Clinton for the Senate, on top of Monica Gate and the new meanings of oral sex. Welcome back, John Updike. Could we talk about Harry? He is a live spirit in our times.
He began in 59 in my imagination as one of those basketball players, one of those high school athletes whose adult life is anticlimactic and hasn't been anything so good since he was 18 flying down the court. And this is certainly was an American type, and I suspect still exists. To me, he was an intelligible and sympathetic embodiment of the male predicament, maybe the human predicament, in fact, the tug between doing your duty and doing right and being decent to the people around you, and on the other hand, the wish to move on, to fulfill yourself, to find the whatever it is that's waiting for you. He's on some kind of a crazy quest. His basketball moments have given him the sense of entitlement, I think they say now. It's a youth-admiring culture, and so for men and women alike, the answer is, after youth, what? What's left except trying to struggle to stay young?
It seems to me, if I may say, the genius of your gift is to make the specter of this man absolutely real. The soul of this man lives. He's there. He's there as certainly as much as Hamlet's father is there as a ghost. He's there in that dream scene. Maybe would you read that?
I'd be happy to. This is Nelson. He's for a moment in his mother's house. One night in early November, Nelson dreams he is lying in his bedroom, which is true, although it is somehow smaller, like the little front room where Ron's computer sits. He gets out of bed when he hears a distant clicking noise. He goes to the window and sees out in the backyard a tall man practicing chip shots in the moonlight. The man is bent over and intent, and a certain sorrow emanates from him in the gray-blue light. His back is turned, and he doesn't turn his head to look up at Nelson, though Nelson dreads that this will happen, a staring white mask in moonlight. Instead, there's just that patient concentration, as if on a task he has been assigned for eternity, the little studied half-swing, a slump-shouldered contemplation of the result, a disconsolate trundling another ball with the face of the club into position at the man's feet, and another studied swing. Nelson feels indignation that this mournful, tall, middle-aged stranger, in nondescript trousers and a long-sleeved blue-gray shirt, should have wandered into their yard from Joseph Street and be trespassing so brazenly, making that irritating, repeating noise in the middle of the night. Neither in his dream nor when woken by it does Nelson announce to himself who the homeless man is. And we know, I assume, we guess that that is Harry practicing chip shots in the afterlife.
1-800-423-8255, The Rabbit Connection with John Updike. Chuck is on the line.
Yes, good morning.
Welcome, Chuck.
Mr. Updike.
Yes?
I want to thank you for saving my life 40 years ago. I was a crazy mixed-up kid. Was it 1960 Rabbit Run came out?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I hopped on a train in Boston to go to New York with the firm intention of jumping off the Empire State Building. And I picked up Rabbit Run to read on the train to keep me occupied. And by the time the train ride was over, I decided not to kill myself because it was just so beautifully written. And it was just the wonderful, wonderful, exuberant, just highly wrought, totally alive writing. And it just made me feel, wow, the world is filled with really new and exciting, beautiful things. And I decided not to kill myself.
Well, I'm very glad and flattered that you ascribe some of that to Rabbit Run. I remember I was 7 or 8 at the time, and very full of my upbringing in Berks County, PA, and really thought I had something to say, that this world, the world I'd lived through, the world I'd grown up in, mm-hmm. really hadn't been described quite before, that Sinclair Lewis hadn't described it, and Steinbeck and Hemingway and many and others hadn't described it, because it really hadn't been there for them. So, yeah, the book was meant to have. And I found as I was writing it that it had a great, lovely fullness, that there was plenty to say, and I really had to kind of curb my wish to say, and I'm glad that some of that spirit got through to you.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you didn't curb too much, because it really saved my life.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Rabbit Connection. Kim is on the line.
Mr. Updike, I want to thank you for all the wonderful fiction you've been writing for years and years that I've been following. I have a question about the rabbit theme that continues on and on. I wanted to know a little bit more about how you personally connect with Rabbit as a character, since he's lasted for decades and decades, as opposed to some of your earlier fiction, say in Museums and Women, the Maple stories, and so forth.
Yeah. Harry Angstrom somehow gives me access to really the land of my youth, to the time of my youth, and to the energies that I felt to be around. You know, you never get impressions quite as potent as your early impressions, and so in that Rabbit has stayed back in Pennsylvania, whereas I have long, long left, he does give me access to the Pennsylvanian within me, and maybe that's why there's a kind of extra energy or an extra appeal here. I have returned, as you noted, to other characters. The Maples return, and of course Henry Beck, the well-known Jewish American writer, is the subject of three books. So I do reuse some characters, but not as thoroughly as I've reused Rabbit.
That was John Updike and me and our callers on The Connection on WBUR at the end of the year 2000. Adam Begley, in his biography, confirms that Updike, a Harvard man, class of 1954, briefly a New Yorker, and then a North Shore Bostonian from his late 20s onward, remained at the core of his writing self a Pennsylvanian, a child of inland America, closer to Ohio than New England. So who was he, after all?
The short answer to your question is who Updike really was. He was a writer. First and foremost, before he was anything else, he was a writer. But you have to have something to write about, and Updike needed to latch on to his roots, to where he came from, to Shillington. And Shillington was hugely important to him because it was the source of his material. What he resented about Harvard was that it tried to turn him into something else. It tried to make him sophisticated and learned, and to detach him, in a sense, from Shillington. And so he was actually quite, grudging about his Harvard education. He was never grudging about Shillington, and he was certainly never grudging about his Shillington High School classmates. He was the class president, and he went to every reunion every 5 years, he treasured it. He needed to keep that connection. He needed to keep that connection because the essence of Updike is detachment. He was detached from everything that was going around him because he was recording it and turning it into art. So there's that bit of distance, and that bit of distance had to be overcome by nostalgia, by a sense of belonging, by a desire to claim as his own this part of America, Shillington, Pennsylvania, or even Plowville, which he hated, but he needed for the material. And then he was the same way about Ipswich. The moment he left Ipswich, he began to use it in the same obsessively nostalgic way.
Adam Begley, let's talk about how he'll be remembered and how we'll remember him. And not everybody remembers him kindly. I mean, there's that Harold Bloom line out there that he was a minor novelist with a major style. I've heard Harold Bloom refer to him as Johnny Upchuck. Norman Mailer dismissed him as Little Johnny Updike up there in the irrelevant burbs in New England. There was this sort of unresolved but really admiring tension with Philip Roth, etc. A lot of women despise him, feel he demeaned them. Mm-hmm. I'm not of that school, but part of my not close friendship with John Updike, but great interest, expressed in a letter I sent to him in 1989, 25 years ago, about his self-consciousness, in which I simply said, "You get almost enough credit for the grace and God-given talent on every page, but not enough, I think, for the hard reflection, the courage, the generosity on every page of that book, specifically about being a man, mm-hmm. in a man's body, with a man's contradictions, with a man's temptations, with a man's excitement." To me, he's one of the great guides, and I recommended him to my daughters. I said this to him on the radio. Like, if you want to know something about guys, you've got to read Updike, because he's telling it truthfully.
Yeah, I think that he's certainly good on being a boy, and I think he got better at understanding women. The feminist rap against him begins in the 60s, and I think in the 60s it was somewhat merited. Character after character in Updike stories and Updike novels from the 60s, the women are referred to as dumb or shallow, and very often, they are mere objects of male gaze. But very quickly, when he's criticized for this, he begins to work on it. And I think he worked on it all his career. And if you take a character like Janice, for example, Rabbit Angstrom's wife, in the first novel, and then look again at Janice when you get to Rabbit is Rich, or even the little sequel, Rabbit Remembered,
which I love,
you'll see a woman who is very sympathetically, very deeply drawn, real attempt to see from her perspective. And so I think that, to get back to your original question, how will he be remembered? I think the feminist anti-vote on Updike will never carry. he's going to be loved equally by men and women.
He became famous. He became rich himself for writing about sex in the suburbs. In the long run, I mean, is that important?
It was important at the time. I find couples a little bit difficult to deal with these days. I find it too long. I think it's overwritten. And the sex, though it's gorgeously rendered, there's a bit too much of it. His first wife, Mary, to whom it was dedicated, famously said that when she read it, she felt she was being smothered in pubic hair. I think that a lot of people, especially women, might feel the same way reading it now. Updike wanted to write a satire of a permissive society, but he got carried away by his own fascination with description and with sex and describing sex. And so it's not clear that it's a satire as you're reading it. It's sometimes also a celebration. And it's also, to go back to one of your themes, a very spiritual book. It's about religion in a deep way.
It froze his reputation, especially for people who hadn't read him, as the guy up there in the horny burbs sort of doing it all.
Well, one of the problems is that not only did he write couples, but then he went on and wrote story after story about suburban sex, and even published another novel about suburban sex called Marry Me. What nobody knew before my book is that Marry Me was written before couples. It was published in 1976, but it was actually written in 1964, and it was very much about his first love affair with a woman named Joyce Harrington. Once he'd written it, he realized he couldn't publish it without destroying his marriage and broadcasting his infidelities to the world. So he put it literally into a safe deposit box at the Ipswich Bank and kept it there for 12 years. And then when it came out, everybody reviewed Marry Me and said, there's Updike banging on about adultery again. Well, it wasn't really banging on again. It was his first attempt to write about adultery, and he'd suppressed it.
What about the fact that he never really produced a great novel?
That's tricky. I think that you get around that, if you're me, by saying, as Updike did, that the Rabbit Tetralogy should be considered a mega novel. And if you look at the four of them together, then it is a great novel. It's a very odd great novel, four of them. I have a particular favorite. I think that Rabbit Redux is by far the strongest of these books. I'm in the minority there. Updike clearly wanted you to begin at the beginning and work to the end. I always advise people to begin with the third novel, Rabbit is Rich, then read the beautiful Rabbit at Rest, and then if you're hooked, which you will be, I believe, go back and discover where did this man come from, and go back and read Rabbit Run, and then finish with the explosive and extraordinarily powerful and disturbing Rabbit Redux.
And how about Rabbit Remembered?
Rabbit Remembered is a wonderful novella. I think of it as apart from the other four books. Rabbit is remembered in it. He doesn't, of course, appear in it, being dead. But I think that's really more tidying up the characters around Rabbit.
I'm in the minority that doesn't absolutely worship the Rabbit novels. I think of them as his great collected observations on the changing decades, and nobody noticed more things than he. The novels I prefer, actually, are his spiritual searches, especially A Month of Sundays, which it turned out he liked a lot. This is about a sort of minister who had sinned and was banished for a while into a sort of colony of ministers under discipline. But it was one of, like Roger's version, it was one of those spiritual inquiries. And I thought that was sort of the core of Updike's project.
Interesting. Month of Sundays is a very unusual novel. It's very much under the influence of Nabokov, very tricksy, very full of pyrotechnic display. One of the interesting things about it is that it confirms Updike's genius for writing out what's going to happen to him before it happened.
Hmm.
So that's about a minister who is expelled from his parish. And of course, that it's written 2 years before Updike himself was expelled from Ipswich for his dalliance with his second wife. So it's an imagining of how it would play out to break out from his family. He'd done this before with another novel that I consider one of his greatest, which is Of the Farm, which he wrote in 1965. And it's about going to visit a man going to visit his widowed mother, bringing along with him his second wife and their stepson. Well, Updike was happily married at the time, and his father was alive, so his mother wasn't widowed. But lo and behold, 10 years later, Updike is going to visit his widowed mother on her farm with his second wife and stepson. So he had written the events before they occurred.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, speaking of John Updike this hour with his biographer, Adam Begley. Also with his presiding fan in life and death. Nicholson Baker made his young reputation in the late 80s with two idiosyncratic works of something like photorealism in prose. And then in 1991, he wrote a book called You and I, just those capital letters, a whole book, as he said, about my obsession with Updike, a sort of love letter to a man he'd met once and just barely that. Dick Baker spoke with me not so long ago about missing his hero and his model.
He had an amazing ability to be in the present, but to be in the present as a person with a fully functioning, smoothly and high horsepower kind of prose engine that allowed him to get the truth down on the page quickly and move on and be just thrillingly specific. And I miss him terribly, honestly. I just miss him terribly. There were some years where I thought, well, God, I've really said what I have to say about Mr. Updike. And I was kind of embarrassed in a way that I had revealed so much. And also that I had plagued him with a book that then people would say, what do you think about that book about you? And I felt embarrassed that he would have to have something to say about it. I know somebody came up to me yesterday saying, I went up to Updike and I gave him your book to sign. And I thought, that poor man, you know, dogged by this fan. It wasn't what I imagined, and yet it was what I imagined. I wanted to write a book that would be kind of eagerly following him. So there were some years where I tried not to think about him. More recently, though, I have taken to those enormous compendiums that he would publish every 10 years or so of essays and criticisms, book reviews, just one amazing book review after another, one on the Titanic, one on some Eastern European writer who's forgotten, something about a history of a great American novelist thrown in, just there, these enormous books, and I've never been able to read them through, but I park now in a nearby park, and I go into a park bench and look at the waterfall, and I open one of these big, fat Updike books, and I read aloud something. I read something about the Book of Matthew recently. He just did an amazing job of describing the history and the scholarly disagreements surrounding the Book of Matthew, and I felt that I learned so much. The man was still alive, you know. The man was still thinking on the page, but the poignancy of that was that, of course, he isn't, and we have to say it. He was the most amazing. I mean, prose stylist is one of those absurd phrases that sounds so sterile, but he was a fashioner of charitable sentences and of thoughts that surround ideas like no other. And I felt that I missed him more personally in sitting in the park bench reading these big, heavy books recently than for many years.
Adam Begley, the biographer, left us with the thought of delights yet to come from John Updike, the letter writer. That is, you learn more about Edith Wharton in her letters and about Ronald Reagan in his, too. I have my own interest in the Updike letters because I received some of them and a small stack of postcards from the man, always playful and generous, though I had to wonder at the time if he was making the right use of his time and his talent.
I fervently hope that his correspondence will be published because it's absolutely brilliant. That's the side of Updike that no one has yet seen, and it will add a whole new dimension to people's admiration for him. There are two different, three or four different parts of his correspondence. The most important, in a way, is the correspondence with his mother. His mother was a writer, though Updike always referred to her as an aspiring writer. There was a little competition there. Her best writing is her letters to him. And he replied, working hard to match her or to better her. It was a bit of a competition. And the letters between them are absolutely magical. And I hope someday that they see light.
Is there any question about that? That they will see light?
Yes. The Updike estate at the moment says that Updike did not want his letters published and that they will not be published. I don't believe that that will stick. I think that they will change their minds about that. And I've never seen it in writing, Updike saying he didn't want his letters published. He kept them in all very good order and deposited them at the library. So he clearly wanted them read. I don't know why, if he wanted them read in a library, he wouldn't want them published.
Well, you wonder. I mean, thank God he didn't burn them the way Henry James burned his. But what did he intend? He had saved everything, matchbooks, restaurant napkins. I mean, what did he want?
I assume that he wanted to be remembered. Updike was absolutely terrified to die and absolutely terrified to be forgotten. I think if you scratched him hard enough, he would have said, of course, publish my letters. He actually, even in one of his letters to his mother, discusses, this was when he was at Harvard still, discusses removing the personal bits and having their correspondence published. He knew that that this was a great correspondence.
What's the other great meat in this endless file of correspondence?
Well, there's two other great sources. One is his correspondence with his New Yorker editors.
In your book, they're marvelous. William Maxwell.
Yeah, William Maxwell. And also his correspondence with Catherine White, E.B. White's wife. There aren't that many letters. There are only about 40 or 50, as opposed to William Maxwell, where there are about 200 or 300. But all these letters, in some ways, I remember writing a note to myself when I started reading the correspondence with William Maxwell. And the note said, the best Updike ever is in his letters to William Maxwell. He trusted Maxwell to understand him entirely. And he was completely at ease. And he was funny, sharp, charming, consummately professional. It's a marvelous display of wit and talent. And he just tossed these off. I mean, they just poured out of him. His letters to his mother are fascinating and wonderful, but they don't have that kind of somersaulty feel to them, you know, that I can do anything on the page and I'm going to do it right now for you, William. Bill, as he called him.
You can puzzle a long time about what's important here, what will last, was it important at all, and then you pick up those stories again, mm-hmm. and you realize those sentences are important. That writer was important. It's not just craft, it's a kind of genius that bursts through that prose. And I hate to think of that being forgotten or put down.
I don't think that it will be forgotten. I think he will always be recognized as a master of the short story. I find it very difficult to believe that anyone will look back on the second half of the 20th century and judge the short stories written then and not list Updike in the top few practitioners. I think there's no question about that.
With
John Cheever, with J.D. Salinger, not with, Philip Roth or Saul Bellow, who were wonderful writers and might be considered better novelists than Updike. But Updike, you have to remember, could do it all. He could write short stories that were with the best written at the time, or any time. He could write poems that were really much better than anyone has given them credit for. He wrote 20-plus novels, some of which are superb. But you have to remember that he was also a critic. He was one of the best critics of the second half of the 20th century.
A global reader.
Completely. He toured the planet finding books for to amuse him, to feed his work, and to feed his readers. He was a very generous reviewer. He always reviewed books with the reader in mind, not to show off, not to put down a writer he didn't like, not to parade his knowledge, but to bring the news to his reader.
I want to come back to the stories, Adam Begley. You very usefully have given The Guardian your 10 nominations of the all-time Updike best stories. Take one or two and explain the magic of these things.
Well, maybe I'll take the first one and the last one. The first one I chose was a story called The Happiest I've Been, which is a very beautiful story about nostalgia and about growing up and about wanting to keep your past the way you remember it, but also to leave that past behind. And it's the first time that Updike used nostalgia in a way that engages the reader so completely, because as you read it, you become nostalgic for your own past, and even nostalgic for this character's past. It's an almost insane piece of literary trickery.
Should I say it's a New Year's Eve party back in his hometown in Pennsylvania, very literal rendition of his beloved high school classmate.
Absolutely.
As he's heading back to Harvard by way of Chicago, where he's meeting his girlfriend, new girlfriend.
This is all exactly as it happened. We even have the letters in which he's looking forward to this party. He goes to this party and he describes it with a precision that is completely eerie. And he remembers writing it and feeling as though he were making some huge breakthrough in his craft. And I think he did. It is a story that is tremendously moving in its particularity, the way he invests tiny details with emotional significance. The last story I chose was My Father's Tears, which is a very similar story in some ways, which is it's about, again, a kid coming back to his hometown to visit his parents and going away again. And again, he's going away to meet a woman who is going to be the rest of his life. And this time, it's a less electric performance. The details are fine, they're well chosen, but they don't have the tremendous emotional energy that the earlier work did. What you get instead is a kind of wisdom in it. It's a story that you read and you realize that the author knows what life is about. And you come away feeling that you know a little bit more what life is about when you've read it. What's astonishing is that those stories were written 50 years apart. And they're dealing with the same material. And you would, you know, I'm sure there are people out there who would say, oh, it's the same old Updike stuff about wishing you could keep things as they are, but wanting to escape from them. But for me, it hooks me entirely. And I think that those stories will endure.
One last thing on Updike, the spiritual writer, because I think it's important. It was important to me. One of my beloved Updike pieces was something he tossed out probably in an hour for National Public Radio and our friend Jay Allison in their series, This I Believe. And Updike took it seriously, answered it professionally, but he said wonderful things like this. He said, why he writes fiction, I find in my own writing that
only fiction, and rarely a poem, fully tests me to the limits of what I know and what I feel.
But then on the belief question, he answered, I love this. Cosmically, he says,
I seem to be of two minds. The power of materialist science to explain everything, from the behavior of the galaxies to that of molecules, atoms, and their submicroscopic components, seems to be inarguable and the principal glory of the modern mind. On the other hand, the reality of subjective sensations, desires, and, may we even say, illusions, composes the basic substance of our existence, and religion alone, in its many forms, attempts to address, organize, and placate these. I believe, then, that religious faith will continue to be an essential part of being human, as it has been for me.
It was very important for him. He needed regular observance. He had to go to church on a pretty much regular basis.
And sing the hymns.
Sing the hymns. He needed to have personal faith. He had crises of faith, and when they occurred, they could be debilitating. They were often accompanied by acute fear of panic, of fear of death.
Adam Begley, you listed your 10 favorite stories, which was generous. For the record, and the road, are there five, of all the Updike production, five that you'd recommend to everybody?
There's a poem I love called The Rescue. I don't know how well known it is, but it means a lot to me. It's about Updike thinking about his writing and whether it will last, and then thinking about saving a bird from inside his garden shed. And it's a gorgeous description of that. And you think, yes, of course, he prefers the action of saving a bird to the business of sitting in his desk and writing. But then, of course, you realize that unless he'd sat at his desk and written, we would never know about rescuing the bird. And we wouldn't have that gorgeous description of rescuing the bird. I love Of the Farm. I think it's a small gem of a novel with just four voices. A perfect little novel, tiny and perfect. I think Self-Consciousness is a great memoir.
Me too.
I can't think, actually, of a major American writer who has written a better memoir. And having written this biography, I have to say that the story Separating has become hugely important to me because I see it as the place where his biography intersects most poignantly with his art.
Was he really terrified of death at the end? It was fascinating to me that he discovered his lung cancer in a late stage. He did not have either chemo or radiation or any other major therapy that we know of. And he shriveled and died pretty fast. But how do we know what he was thinking at the end?
Well, I talked to friends and I talked to family. He was angry at the end not to be able to write anymore. As long as he could write, and he did write up till about 4 weeks before his death, I think he was probably okay. And the book he produced in those last weeks, Endpoint, is one of his best books. It's a tremendously brave performance. Was he afraid at the end? I don't know. There's a point at which biographers have to let go and say there are things we'll never know. I hope he wasn't, because he was a good man.
Adam Begley's biography is called Updike. There are links to our own collection of Updikeiana on our website, radioopensource.org. including Adam Begley's list of his top 10 Updike stories, plus letters, videos, some notes to me, and more. Add your own notes there about what you miss most about Updike, if you do. You can follow us on Twitter at Radio Open Source. You can subscribe on iTunes for lots more podcasts. Our show was produced and edited by Mary McGrath. It was mixed by our engineer, George Hicks. We had help from Max Larkin, Cornell Jasty, Matt Ellison, and Will Maddowse. Thanks also to the Boston Athenaeum and to Dick Johnson at the New England Sports Museum. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.